was writing a letter to her uncle that was still over there in the Mamaday area. And this man was so impressed with this that he picked it up and he sent it back to his wife, who was in Oklahoma. And she, in turn, in a very coincidental turn of events, got the letter back to Mrs. Rudinger, who was in DeHennis at the time as an old lady who had come back to DeHennis in her later years. And in this letter, it talked about the fact that young girls in DeHennis back in the 1880s were able to earn more money than young men could by working in the hotel or whatever, and things like this. And it was just a real newsy little letter that she had written to her uncle in Germany. It had been kept and saved over there. As I said, here we have a very unusual example of something. But what if we were to find these all over Europe, and what if somehow or another these could get back to us in some way? And, you know, those of us that have established contacts with family and friends still in the area, in France and the Rhineland and Friesland, if we could find some way of getting some research done over there to bring back some of these if they're still available, you know, what we could learn from that is almost, they would say a lot, as it were. Another source that we have for information about these women was stories that they told to their children. Stories that were passed down from one generation to the next. Stories about their heritage, where they came from, how they came here, what they did. Because, you see, there were no memoirs written to speak of. There might have been a few. I've not seen many, certainly. There were no diaries kept by these people out here on the frontier, because writing of diaries and memoirs is something normally associated with a leisure class of people who have time on their hands and an inclination to write. And, you know, if anyone writes their memoirs, they're usually writing these for publication. And just to give you an example how few people at that time wrote diaries, how many of you today keep a diary in your subtle environment here? Who keeps a diary? Connie Cook keeps a diary. Wonderful.
On trips.
Well, you know, this is a great thing to do this, I think, because someday people might look back here and say, what did our aunts and uncles and grandparents and people like this do on a day-to-day basis? How did they live their lives? What meant something to them? What were the events of the day, and how did they react to these? What did they think about it? Well, unfortunately, no one that I know of have been able to find anything about anyway, wrote anything like this on the day-to-day living on the frontier. Yes, ma'am. You do what? Excuse me, I didn't hear you, ma'am. Mm-hmm. This is wonderful. These calendars that have small blocks there around the numbers, any little old thing can be written on that and then save the calendars, as the lady said. That's wonderful. What is your name, ma'am? I didn't get that. Oh, sure. Okay. Right. Her name is Rose Zara Kent. Comes from south of DeHennis on the Saco Creek, right? All right. Know where you're from. Okay, yes, ma'am. Well, this is something to really be, you know, encouraged. And those of you that feel like, gosh, I'm too old to write a diary, it's too late in life to do this, you know, no, it isn't, really. You know, your viewpoint is very valuable, and the longer you keep this, the more valuable it becomes. So look what we've lost here by one group of people, one generation, that didn't do this. And now look how much we'd appreciate that if we had it 100 years later. So, you know, I wanted to make a point of that we didn't have much of that. And so what we have now is just pieced together references. So let's try to look at the average or the life of the day of an everyday housewife, I guess, or whatever, on the frontier. How would it start out? And if you can follow this little scenario, let's see how close to reality you think it might be, okay? Early in the morning, cook on an open with a wood fire that needs wood chopped up in 6-inch lengths to fit into the stove. And maybe you didn't even have a stove at that time. Maybe this was campfire cooking early and initially when you got here. And then after that, there were the children to take care of. And most pioneer women had large families, which meant that if they had a child every 2 years, they normally had just given birth or were pregnant. I mean, on a reality situation here, this is what it was. So there were all problems with that. Okay, so then breakfast is prepared, whatever it might be. Bacon, things like this. We think bacon and eggs today, maybe this is something they had back then, but what did they eat on a day-to-day basis for breakfast? They kept chickens, they had that. If they didn't, what else would they have? Potatoes? I'm sure their daily fare was so much different from ours today that we just accept the fact. When we try to imagine what they did, we try to put them in our situation, unless we know directly. I'd like to know, really, what they cooked for breakfast, for lunch, for supper, whatever. And then, okay, so let's follow through the day then. The children are probably, if the woman is in her 40s, she probably has maybe 8 children. They married young, and they had children up to age 45, 46. Having more difficulty probably with the later ones than the earlier ones. Maybe they lost 2-3 children to accidents, to Indians, to whatever. Okay, so they have their children. Now somebody has to do something about clothing these children. Where do they get the clothes? They make them. They take their, they buy their cloth in San Antonio, maybe, if they're lucky enough, or they take their cotton and they cord it out themselves and make their fabric and make the little shift that the children would wear and the mother would wear during the day. Her husband had cotton shirts and broadcloth pants. They were probably bought somewhere, more than likely. But the mother was responsible, if not for making these, then certainly for darning them and patching them and cleaning them and washing them, with which she might have to use her lye soap that she would make with ashes and animal fat, mix it together and make her lye soap. She had to do that. She probably had to mold lead bullets for her husband to use in his pistol or his rifle, whatever. And so on, and then it's time for the next meal to cook that and get that going. And then later in the day, then she might have to go out and help her husband in the field or hunting or working with the cattle, as this one lady did that we saw in there, that jumped on her Mustang and rode out across the prairies. This is a day-to-day thing. When was their time to write? When was their time to do anything except exist, to make things prepared there and be ready for the next meal or end the day absolutely exhausted, waiting for the next day? Somebody had to make tallow candles for them. They had to, make their molds and do this. And all of this is on the back of the woman. A lot of times, the man might be gone from home for a week. Maybe his farm is so far away from town that he can only come home on weekends. Or he might be hunting and gone for a while, and then everything is on her to do. The garden that must be kept for the vegetables and all of that. Look at the frustrations that might have been involved with that. Bringing flowers and seeds and things like that from Europe over here. Trying to make something of a home over here that somewhat resembles that there. And planting these and watching them grow, and then have the deer come in and eat up the flowers and stomp it all out, or the cattle get loose and come in here and ruin it all. Little things like that, too, that went along with the big problems like the cholera outbreaks that would come through and mess up the water. And you don't know your water supply is bad until your kids start getting sick and you start watching them, some of them die. And we did have cholera outbreaks, especially along these creeks. Tonka Creek and Seco and the Medina, and a lot of these creeks would dry up during some times of the year. The water would stagnate and cholera and typhoid and like that were a big problem. On an aside here, I want to tell you something that I found the other day. I was talking about Tonka Creek over here somebody over there. I haven't found anything about a Parker family. And so what I'm thinking is, and I'm going to put this as almost a hypothesis here, is that the Parker Creek is actually Parca Creek, P-A-R-C-A, a Spanish word that stands for frugal or moderate or intermittent flow, you know. And this pretty well describes it. Here we have a Spanish name that has been anglicized and made into an English name. And we accept the name of that stream over there today as Parker Creek, when actually it was a Spanish name, Creek. And I could just see an American map maker coming down here and making that wrong assumption on that. I just thought I'd throw that in. Doesn't have anything to do with wimps, okay? Okay. Looking at other things here that... Now, here's the part that I want you to think about, because from here on, this program is going to be yours in a lot of ways, and I'm going to facilitate this. I want us to look at this everyday lifestyle of the pioneer women, and think. And I want you to think about your heritage now, your grandmother, or your mother, perhaps, or your old aunt, or great aunt, or whatnot, as far back as you can. And let's try to imagine what they were putting up with now on this day-to-day basis as I go through this next list of items here that I want to use to stimulate your ideas here. And when I'm finished here, I'm going to ask you to identify someone in your family that you feel like deserves some special recognition here as someone who is a conservator of civilization or whatever. It doesn't have to be that grandiose. Let's just talk about somebody who you feel like contributed significantly to the community, or to you, or to your family, or who inspired someone in your family to do something, a mother or a grandmother or somebody like that. And let's get this on record here, because we have a tape recorder here. And I want to identify these people on a very personal basis. We can talk about pioneer women here all day in the general, but it doesn't mean anything until we put names on this. And let's talk about people and events and circumstances. So be thinking about this, and well, I want to get into that in a little bit. I want to talk here about some specific problems here that were dealt with, and how these were endured. First of all, there was the Indian situation. And let me tell you a little story here that I read here in Marvin Hunter's book. Imagine this woman who goes off to help her sick sister and leaves her husband and three children at home. And when she gets back home, she finds her husband near death. The Indians have struck the house before she left, I mean after she left. Her three children are gone. The ages are 11, 8, and 6. The two oldest children are boys, 11 and 8, and her daughter is 6. They're gone. Her husband's near death. Okay? This happened to the Crawitz family about 10 miles north of Castroville in the 1860s. Okay, as it happened, there was a Texas Ranger company under the command of Taylor Thompson, who was patrolling in the western Bandera County in the vicinity of the headwaters of the Medina River, which those of you today, if you're familiar with that area, you know it's up a little bit northwest of the town of Medina. It's a very rough country. Okay, it's 10:30 at night, and you're Taylor Thompson, the ranger captain, and you have a party of 14 rangers with you. And the moon is coming out, and it's a dark night, and the moon is passing between the puffy white clouds, and you're out checking your horses to be sure the Indians don't come into your camp and steal them, and you hear somebody whisper, "Hey, mister, are you a white man?" And he turned around and he looked and he found this little 11-year-old boy there. And he said, "You know, what's going on here?" And the boy said, "Well, I just escaped. My brother and I here just escaped from this Indian camp. But our little sister is still being held back there." And so this group of rangers gets these two little boys together and they go back to the camp and find it by this little boy's direction. Early in the morning, they strike the camp just before daylight, and to make a long story short, they rescue the little girl unharmed, and 2 or 3 days later, they're back north of Castroville delivering these three children alive and well back to their mother. Now imagine the relief of this woman to find that her family is okay again. The children Hubert Wine and Mrs. Miller, who lived north of Dehannes, who had to have someone come to them and tell them that, number one, the Winan child, who I'm sure is an ancestor here of Dr. Jerome Winan and other people here, had been captured by the Indians and carried off, and that the youngest boy of the party there, Miller child, had been killed by the Indians. And this word had to be carried back to their parents. And imagine now, if you will, the feelings of despair to find that, you know, that they had died and were lost. Of course, this lost child was never heard of again. They never were able to find this captured boy, this young Winan boy, never was heard of again. Okay, imagine the plight now of a mother who let her older children take their youngest brother, 2 years old, down to the Seco to go swimming, and then come running back home and say, Mama, Mama, the baby is drowned, he's gone. This is an everyday life thing, too. So here we have things are, and of course, you know, this doesn't change much over time. Today we still deal with this. This happens, but it's not on as frequent a basis as it was back then. And so these things happen. Okay, now let's look at the mother that's home, and this is the 1860s, and your husband is off in the Confederate Army, and you're a young mother at home with two young daughters. In the middle of the night, you hear a group of men ride out in the front yard and knock on the front door, and when you get there, they stick a rifle in your face and say, "Where's your husband? He's a deserter. We came here to find him. You know, we want to bring him back to justice." You know, what do you tell somebody like that? You know, how do you deal with this? You tell them, "Hey, you know, my husband's in the army." They'll say, "Well, prove it. How do we know you're telling us the truth?" You know, these things went on. This was a very hard time for us to live through or to think about, because it was such, you know, it was people turning against their neighbor during this great schism that we have here, the Civil War situation. We don't have that today. We have law and we have order. Back then they had law, but they had no order. And that's the difference, I think, in times then and today. Another area here that an interesting thing happened here is this Ms. Annie Brown, I was telling you about a while ago, lived somewhere in the area of Divine. She came here from Louisiana as a young bride, and her husband brought her here. They sold everything they owned on the plantation, and they were going to go to California. This is during the Civil War. Well, they got as far as Austin. They found out they couldn't go any further because the road conditions and so forth, and so they tried to go into Mexico and go across that way, and they couldn't make it. So they were coming back to San Antonio. And this was, I think this was about a year or so after they'd left New Orleans, coming this way. Anyway, she was pregnant and soon to deliver, and her husband was trying to establish a shipping freighting company. So he left her with a Bippert family on Seuss Creek, close to Castroville. She stayed with them a while, and waiting for her husband to get his shipping or freighting business going, and then she moved in with the Santaleben family. While she was with the Santaleben family, she had her child and had this baby in the house, and one day while she was in there alone, this man comes walking in the house, a stranger, and walks up to the bed of her baby and looks at it and wants to pick it up, and she goes over there and she said, "What are you doing?" And she recognizes him as a crazy man from the community who's a lunatic, and he's a fugitive. And the guy says, "I'm here to make angels for God. I'm supposed to kill babies to make angels for God." You know, what's she going to say? So she goes and she calls Ms. Sandleben, and they come back in the room, and Mrs. Sandleben is a very quick-thinking person, and she said, "Well, wait a minute. Now, you can't do that yet. Put the baby down. First of all, you have to take communion before you can make babies. I mean, you know, make angels." So, yeah, that's right. I guess I better. So she distracts him, and in the meantime, the young mother and her baby leave the house and run away through a back door. And then the young lady feels concerned about the security of Mrs. Sandleben, so she goes back in the house and tries to get her out, and the lunatic or whatever he is follows them out there and still tries to threaten them. And this is during the time of the Civil War when there's no men around to help them. There's only small boys who didn't want to get involved here. They were afraid to do anything. Okay, I'm dragging this on, I'm sure, too long here. As I said, as you go through this, you find out there's so much material here. There's so much we could talk about here today in terms of individual personalities and experiences that happen on a day-to-day basis that we could drag this down to a book form, and maybe someday I'll do that. I don't know. But anyway, I think the role that women held in our community is certainly one we've acknowledged here today, and certainly in the opening prayer. We did this, and we're saying that we recognize the efforts of these people and what they did and what they've meant to us here, and we look around us and we see the land we have today, and we wonder how we got here. Well, the men might have been out there doing the hard work and the lifting and the loading and the shooting and the fighting and so forth and the arguing in the halls of justice, but it was the women at home who followed the role of Sarah from the Bible that were really probably the ones that we owe a large debt to. And I want to close here with something that J. Marvin Hunter wrote in his book, History of Bandera County. He says, "These women gave up the comforts and pleasures of society, severed the tenderest ties of the human heart, home and kindred, the old altars where they prayed, the graves of their loved and lost, these, the dearest things to a woman's heart, that we today might enjoy in their fullest fruition what they lost. And I think that's where we are today. We're here to say thank you, if belated, and we want to now hear from you, if you would please think about your family and your, the important women in your heritage, in your life. And let's hear from you on a very personal basis about this, what these people mean to you and what they did for the good of their society and their community. Who would like to start this off? Henry Martin, you look like you're deep in thought there. anybody here that would like to say something about that? Well, let me tell you, while you're thinking there about a great-grandmother of mine that I felt like was probably very much of a resource to her community, her name was Catherine Sada. She came over here as a young girl from East Friesland with her mother and her stepfather, and en route here, her mother was killed in a car wreck crossing the Salado Creek. And so she came out here, and then her stepfather joined the Texas Rangers and farmed her out with some other families in the Guihi area to raise, and she and her brother, F.E. Sada. And over the years, several good families in that community took care of these orphan children, took them into their home, raised them as their own, and then as she entered the teenage years, she came to Castroville there and lived with the Incan family and went to the Sisters of Divine Providence, where she learned to read and write and became educated there by the good sisters. And when she turned 19, she wanted to get off on her own and boarded the stagecoach and headed west. A young lady alone with no visible means of support other than her own ambitions of what she thought she could do. And she came to Dehennis and she stopped at the Jonai station there and asked for a job to keep house and so forth, and was hired, and over the years was able to write lots of letters for people who were illiterate and wanted to write letters back home or across the water or whatever. And in the process married my great-grandfather, John Fawn, and established quite a family there in Medina County. And I always felt like this lady, she went through some pretty tough times growing up, and thank God for the people who took her in as an orphan child and raised her and, brought her along and gave her that opportunity to get her education and then pass it down on to her children. She inspired her children to get an education also, and they did. And so I think this lady, in a way, really meant something to the community there.
my great grandmother, Alexis Bichot, who married Pierre Francois Pintineau in Casterville. She was born in France. In reading the civil records from the region in France, we have found the birth record of, I think, a total of 12 children born to this family. In this family who came from, who were born in France, there were about 12 children who were born. 8 of these children died. The mother of the family decided to stay in France. She had a son who had married, and they were expecting a grandchild. So she said she would not come to this wild country. Instead, she let her husband come, and he brought the other 3 surviving children. Jean-Nicolas Bichot Jr., my great ancestor Alexis, and Jean-Marie. Jean-Marie married the Incan, how you pronounce it? Gerhard Incan. In looking at the old French records, you can see this father as he signed the records when the children were born. You see his signature on the records as they died. You see the signature fairly steady on the death of one child. The entry immediately below it was the death of another child. The signature was not near as steady. It gives us a little idea of why a mother would let her husband bring 3 of her children to this unknown land. Something hopefully would be better for them. We know how hard it had to have been for them here. We're all better and very blessed for the sacrifices they made.
Thank you very much. I've read a lot about the Pintineau family and clients, it's a fascinating family. I appreciate that very much. Anybody else who would like to say something?
Statement I'd like to make about Teresa Billhart Bendeley, who was my grandmother on my mother's side, and it has to do with the dining. As I was sitting here looking at the nice paper plates, and each of us in our homes has several settings of plates. When great-grandmother Teresa was growing up south of Casterville, she used to tell the stories about how they ate outdoors many of their meals, weather permitting, and they had large planks, and she estimated some of them 10 feet long. And they were gouged out in a plate type of fashion, and there were maybe 6 settings on, or staggered on, 6 people could sit on each side, but instead of being directly across, they would often scatter or alternate the plate depressions they used for plates. These were mirrored depressions in rough-hewn logs, and one of her early household chores, she'd have to get the older boys, the brothers, to help her, but they would wash those down with scrub brushes and the old homemade soap and whatever they could get and sand, and then they would lean them up and then throw buckets of water. I see Agnes standing up, and I don't know if Agnes ever supped at a trough like that, but okay. But that's one of the things that Grandma Teresa told me about. The other thing is I think about the sweet corn that we had such a short season on, that it was one of the delicacies that Grandmother Teresa told me about, that if they got hungry and it was nice early corn season in late May, first week in June, south of Casterville, they would go out into the field. They had several rows of their preferred corn they would try to perpetuate, and they would get some corn, take it in, shuck it, and boil it, and sometime 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, this was their snack. And if they had butter, they put butter on it and a little salt and pepper. And she said it just was great.
Thank you, Dr. Wanda. One of these days, I would like to talk to Clemens Finger and have him, if not publicly here, then certainly tell me something of his grandmother, Rhody, and how she dealt with her lifestyle up feel like that those of you here who have, you know, remembrances of mothers and grandmothers, perhaps, that have done something in the past, would certainly write these down for your children and pass them along that way, if not here in a public forum. Let me encourage you to do this. Those of you that think that keeping a diary is something that you could never do, try it for a while and see what you think about it. I think you have things here that you can talk about that might be valuable later on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your opportunity to be here today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Nick. And we want to give you this little book of the history of the sisters. We thought maybe you didn't have that one.
I don't, and I appreciate this.
You can add that to your collection.
Thank you very much.
Well, we know all the time that he has spent working on this talk. It's until you do it, you don't know how hard it is. And he put a lot of time into it, and I think he's made us all aware again of the... of the hardships that our great-grandmothers and so on. He gets a real congratulations there from Clem, and I think that's something. Clem is probably our oldest member here today. Was Clem 91? Clem? 92? 91 or 92?
91 or 92 now?
92. All right, and when you're 92, come to a meeting and hear the speech and congratulate somebody. I think it's wonderful. Hope we're all able to do that. Let's give him a little hand, too. For you. Because you're seeing Clem, we're happy. All right, well. Lucy? All right. Really? Miss Aethinger? How old is Miss Aethinger? Oh, she's going to be 94. Oh, wonderful. Isn't that something? And she made cookies and brought them today for us. So, oh, she cooks for the old folks. Well, we're very happy. Well, you better write them down and or tell them to somebody on a tape recorder if you're ready to quit. You have to do it. Well, we're very happy to have two such wonderful people here today. That's really great that they have the energy to come out in the heat and come to our meeting is really. I think that shows that they still got the stamina of our ancestors. I don't know if we'll have it, but I know they still have it. Now, could we thank them? I'd like to thank the Hondo hosts right now, Vivian Zinsmeyer and Gerald and Betty Hay. Would you stand, the three of you? They're the hospitality chairman. And I know many Hondo members had helped them with today's refreshments, but we thank you for all of your work and the refreshments you're going to have. Yeah. Okay. Agnes, next time don't sit next to that darn thing. If we could all look as good as those two and we get to be 93 or 4 and whatever, great. I have a few announcements before we do break up for refreshments. We have a few copies of the newsletter up here. If you didn't get one or if you'd like an extra one, we have those for you. I have also some copies of the application for the scholarship, and I hope sincerely that you will take advantage of that, or your family or friends. And then along with our speaker's information today, I brought along extra copies of CCHA July 1977 newsletter. Some of you might still have in your files. It's entitled Sweet Alice Remembers the Frontier. It's a great-great-grandmother tells about a different Texas. And this was pioneered with their parents living up in the old Fort Lincoln area in the 1960s, and she recalls the days along the Saco Creek and the families of the Richters, the Rileys, the Binions, the Davenports, the Millers, the Nyes, the Rodies, the Winans, the Reuters. All these people were neighbors in this area, and I think you would enjoy rereading or reading for the first time this newsletter. Nick, I want to thank you very, very much for your coming today and spending time with us and giving us food for thought. Joseph reminds me, talking about age, that Mr. John Messenger, many of you know Mr. John, in Dehennis, will be 100 years old on July 21st. So if you think about it, send a card to Mr. John. He would like it. He's also one of my cousins, too. Larry, are you here today? Larry Bediger? There you are. The Bediger family is having their big reunion on July the 8th, and they have one of the nicest family newsletters I've ever seen. So, and Larry is kind enough to send one to me. But I want to take just a little bit of time and tell you something. For those of you that had ancestors coming on the ship Probus, probably you know about the ship, bringing your ancestors to this country. But you may not know that the ship was built in 1841 in Medford, Massachusetts by a Mr. Jonathan Stetson. The ship was 143 feet in length, 39 feet in width, and 15.5 feet in depth. It had two decks, a square stern, and a figurehead, and weighed approximately 643,2695 tons, whatever that means. And according to articles written about the Probus, it was one of the faster ships built in the early 1940s, and because of that, it was used for many voyages. 1840s. Making transatlantic voyages, and in addition to that, was made many trips in the Far East and the Orient. So I thought you might like that bit of information regarding your ancestors who came along on the Probus. Then I want to remind you also of September the 9th in Dehennis. We'll have our next meeting. We'll be celebrating 15 years along with having a very interesting Probus. Then I also want to remind you folks that in San Antonio on July 14th, we will have Bastille Day celebration. So if you're so inclined, come on out and have some fun with everything French. And don't forget the brochure that Jerome told you about and Cecilia Forrest, the young lady who spoke to you, has a tremendous collection over here of family records. Pinchot, Pichot, Garkheiser, Rüdinger, Zürcher family. Well, Zürcher, Zürcher, depending. Okay. And I'm sure she would like additional information if any of you could help her and read what she has along with her today. And again, I'd like to thank the hostesses. And before we break up, we do have something special. Bertha, where are you? We have a door prize, but how?
We've given you all a number as you signed in here. Would you think of two numbers between 1 and 60?
Nick, think of them.
Oh,
me.
Yes, and you signed in.
You didn't sign in. How many didn't sign in? Well, we thought we had more than 60 people.
Next time, sign in. That'll teach you.
I'm sorry we can't add to it.
Well, we can't add to it now. Okay, I'll think of the number 45. That's a good round number.
Who is 45? Think of the other one.
15. Number 15 and 45. Don't forget, I have my sign-up sheets over here for help at the Medina County Fair in September. you to sign now is because we'll have one more meeting before the fair, but if I could have a new booster list, and I see some of you that helped me last year, don't forget, sign up, and I see someone raising their hand. The September 9th is our next CCHA meeting, and the fair is the next weekend, September the 16th, whatever it is. Have you found the winner? Good. Number 15
is Thelma Brooks.
Thelma Brooks. Where are you? There she is, okay. Bertha. And number 45
is Gertie Hester.
Gertie Hester. Our guest today. Great. How about that? Okay. Thank you all for coming, and let's have some fun and have some refreshments, okay?
We're proud of you.